This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Falava, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Talia Olatia. Coming up, plans to reopen the Porgera mine, a wrap of the Barramundis at the T20 World Cup, and after 551 days apart, the love story reunion that took place in Solomon Islands. But first to PNG, where surging COVID infections in the country have the country's biggest hospital on the verge of collapse. The country is largely unvaccinated, and the rapid spread of Delta is putting incredible strain on its overstretched health system. PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting has more.
Another patient arrives to a hospital that's already full. Infections are overwhelming the Port Moresby General. The COVID wards are full, and so is the emergency department. Now, other areas of the hospital, including part of the maternity wing, are being used. Patients are also being treated at a nearby indoor sports facility. More beds are being set up here, but more staff will need to be recruited before they can open.
We haven't reached a peak and we are already in a crisis. This surge is not discriminating anyone, it's affecting everybody.
The hospital's morgue is full, with bodies now being piled on top of one another. There are 80 coronavirus deaths, but many others are suspected. This week alone, 100 people have been brought to the hospital already dead.
We are planning to do a mass burial this week or next week of 200 bodies so that we can clear some spaces in the mortuary.
Only about 2% of PNG's population is fully vaccinated. Cases are now surging in multiple parts of the country.
We have had 1,706 cases since the 17th of September. 113 of those have been staff.
In Port Moresby, the city's ambulance service is also struggling to meet demand.
We've seen almost a doubling of cases in the city that we're ambulance responses that we're having to do. And as I mentioned, about 50% of those are COVID cases.
The hospital management says an immediate intervention is needed to save the city's fragile health system. The governor of Port Moresby says there are no immediate plans for a lockdown because they're in force here. But he says that may change if things continue to deteriorate in coming days.
PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting there. And it's also concerning because pregnant women and their infants are also testing positive and dying from the virus. Dr. Mary Begita, the coordinator for obstetrics and gynaecology at Port Moresby General, spoke to Jordan Fennell.
We've really had a large, much higher number of women testing positive this time around, and women who've come with more severe symptoms. Since we started seeing a rise in the beginning of September, we've tested more than 100 pregnant women positive.
And have you seen any deaths of pregnant women who have tested positive to COVID-19?
Yeah, so in the last 5 weeks or so since this surge began, we've lost three mothers to COVID. The last one was only last week.
And what about their newborn children, their infants? Are they being impacted as well by the mothers testing positive to COVID-19?
Definitely. These three maternal deaths we've had in the last 2 weeks, they were still pregnant when they died. So they died with their babies in them. So, it's quite distressing because they also came with severe symptoms. So they presented not because of the pregnancy, but because of their COVID symptoms.
And right now, what vaccines are available for pregnant women in Papua New Guinea?
We have AstraZeneca at the moment and J&J coming soon.
Are you seeing hesitancy from pregnant women or when they do present with COVID-19, are they asking to be vaccinated?
Good question. There's a lot of vaccine hesitancy here in the country. Like, it's just widespread, quite unbelievable, even after, we counsel and talk and give messages. It's just overwhelming. So we've got some uptake of pregnant women getting vaccinated, but not enough.
Dr. Birgitta, how many of your colleagues have been infected with COVID-19?
This time around, we've had three doctors out of almost 30 of us in the ONG division. So three so far have been infected. And I guess the benefit is we've all been vaccinated. So our team is 100% vaccinated.
And how long do you think the hospital and the staff at the hospital can sustain these many cases coming in?
Not sure. This surge has just started. Really not sure how long we're going to be able to cope with the situation here. We have our other colleagues in other provinces, been affected by COVID as well. They're calling us for help. We also need to help ourselves. So we're really stretched to the limit.
What support do you need right now to ensure that your team and those at the hospital are going to be able to continue providing maternal services to pregnant women?
I think the main thing is trying to drive vaccination so that we get as many people vaccinated as possible. And our major, major issue is human resource. For doctors in ONG, all of us have been vaccinated. For the midwives, the vaccine hesitancy has been quite high, so quite low vaccination rates amongst midwives. So this time around, a lot of them have fallen ill. It's affecting our care in the labor ward. In the wards, so quite a situation where we're having to, stretch our manpower once again, and this time with a more serious variant.
Yeah, definitely really concerning. What sort of message would you have for women in particular who are pregnant and, would be thinking about coming to use your services at PomGen in the lead up while they are pregnant? What's your message to them at this time?
Firstly, vaccination. That's the number one message. Get vaccinated, protect yourself, protect your unborn child, and protect everyone around you. Pass the message to get vaccinated. Don't listen and watch too many social media, fake news and all that stuff. And the second message is if you're not pregnant, don't get pregnant.
A sobering message there from Dr. Mary Birgitta, the coordinator for obstetrics and gynaecology at Port Moresby General. Staying in PNG, because communities and businesses in the vicinity of PNG's largest mine are calling for its immediate reopening after the government and the mine's owners signed a re-announcement agreement. Porgera Mine is slated to start up again in 2022, but community and business leaders say the restart date is too far off for the many families who rely on the mine for their livelihoods. Caroline Tierman has the story.
The mine was shut down in April 2020 and refused to renew Barrick New Guinea's mining lease. A legal battle last year saw Barrick agree to give PNG more than 50% ownership in the mine and in return securing its place as the mine developer. According to a commencement agreement signed by Prime Minister James Marape and Barrick New Guinea Limited, the mine will reopen in April 2022. For the Porgera Chamber of Commerce and Industry and its 400 members, that's too long, with many of them going to the wall because of cash flow problems. Nixon Pakia, president of the Porgera Chamber of Commerce and Industry, says although they are happy with the recommencement agreement, they want the mine to reopen before Christmas.
We want the Porgera mine to be recommissioned or reopened as soon as possible, because in the last 19 months, our business and our livelihood have been badly affected. Because we do earn income from the mine alone, there is no other source of revenue. We only entirely depend on Porgera mine. Therefore, we want the mine to reopen as soon as possible. I, on behalf of them again, relay our appreciation to the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea and Barrick Chief Executive Officer, Dr. Mark Bristow, for signing the commencement agreement last week Friday. That actually gave us the confidence that Porgera mine will come back to operational. At least we want the mine to be back to normal no later than the end of the year.
Mr. Pakia also says the closure of the mine has affected hundreds of people's lives from Leh in Morobe province, Eastern Highlands, Western Highlands and overseas, with people having no money to pay back bank loans, now surpassing 2 billion kina. Another community leader who wants the mine to reopen is Elizabeth Yarume, president of the Women in Business in Pogira.
Since the mine shut down, everything came to complete stop. Everything came to complete stop. So from there, what do you expect? Like, everyone has been affected. If only there was an exit plan in place, or if there was any relief funds or something like this from the government to look after all the old people, the women, the children, then we could be okay. But given the situation now, it's not like this.
Spencer Wangare is from Paela, a sub-district of Pogera, and he supports the call for the recommencement of the mine.
Just close some 1 kilometer away, but we are still a way back. No road service, no government service, both from government and the company as well. And then all my people from Paela, they all reside in Pogera to get benefit from the mining activities like spin-off business and contract work and all this. And since the mining shut down of mining in 2020, I went to Pogera last month. And then people at the village, their cash flow, everything's dried up. And a lot of people die of sickness and like that. And there's no cash flow. All the migrants from other districts and provinces, they left for their homeland. Only the people that are suffering right now is people from Pogera and Paela. Because of the mining shut down, I don't know what reasons they did that at the national level and like that, but...
But a former Minister of Petroleum and Energy in the Somare government, Francis Potapé, says the mine should not have been closed.
I am not sure what is really going on there, but in my honest opinion, the closure was not necessary. The mine should have been kept operating, but under some sort of arrangement until they come up with this, finalize this sort of arrangements. Because a lot of lives have been affected.
The commencement agreement is the first step in reopening the mine, including the setup of a new Pogera project company, which will be responsible for mining operations.
Caroline Tierman there with that report.
Pacific Beat features interviews with leaders, newsmakers, and the people who make the Pacific Beat.
Really using my experience of this expedition to really promote education in STEM for young Pacific Islanders.
We've got our own internal goals and how well we want to do. I'm confident with the team that we're going to compete week in, week out.
Listen live weekdays on ABC Radio Australia, follow us on Facebook, or search for ABC Radio Australia in your browser to catch up on stories from the Pacific.
This is not something that is exclusive to Papua New Guinea and to Miss PNG. Any woman that puts herself in the public eye all over the world is at risk of experiencing this kind of backlash.
We've got some wonderful players and they're all over the globe. So if we can get them on board and get them qualified, get them interested in playing, we stand a very good chance of doing something special at the 2023 World Cup.
Pacific Beat, weekdays at 6 a.m, 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. PNG time.
You're listening to Pacific Review with me, Talia Olatia. The reality didn't quite match the dream for Papua New Guinea as they made their debut at the men's T20 Cricket World Cup finals in the Gulf. The Barramundis failed to win any of their three games, but after 2 years without any competitive action because of COVID-19, it was always going to be a hard slog for them. However, as Richard Hewitt reports, the plan now is to learn from the experience and to bounce back bigger and better for the next World Cup in 12 months' time.
When they stepped out for their first match against Oman, it was an emotional occasion for the Papua New Guinea players, three of whom have sadly lost a parent back home while they were preparing for the tournament. So no surprise then that there were tears when the PNG national anthem was played prior to the start of play. Batting first, the Barras were going well enough when captain Asad Vala and all-rounder CJ Amini were together, but when Amini was run out, the innings fell away, and although Vala made 56, PNG's total of 9 for 129 didn't look enough. And so it proved as joint hosts Oman blitzed their way to a 10-wicket win with more than 6 of their 20 overs in hand, just the third time that a team had won a T20 World Cup game without losing a wicket. Next up for the Barras was a game against old rivals Scotland, and this time PNG put up a real fight. The Scots batted first and reached 9 for 165, but that score would have been a lot higher if PNG hadn't taken 6 wickets in the last 2 overs, with Kabua Vagimareya taking 4 for 31 and Chad Soper 3 for 24. In reply, the Barramundis made another disastrous start and slumped to 5 for 35 after 6 overs. But then Norman Vanua rallied the cause, first with Sesa Bau and then wicketkeeper Kipland Darriga to put PNG back in the hunt. But after Vanua was dismissed for 47, the Barras were all out for 148, falling 17 runs short. Their final game was against test-playing nation Bangladesh, with the number one T20 player in the world, Shakib Al Hassan, in their ranks. And he was going well until he was dismissed for 46, thanks to a spectacular catch by CJ Amini off the bowling of his captain, Asad Vala.
It's wide and it's pulled out. What a catch! Charles Amini, that's the catch of the week. There has not been a better one.
Bangladesh closed on 7 for 181, a total that proved to be well beyond PNG, as they suffered yet another huge batting collapse, and halfway through the 11th over, they were 7 for 29. Only wicketkeeper Kipland Darriga offered any real resistance, and when the last of the Barramundi's wickets went down with a score on just 97, Darriga was still there on 46. So another big defeat to end on for the Barras, but coach Carl Sandry's team can take a lot of positives from the tournament, and certainly against Scotland they looked more like their old selves and proved that they were worthy to be part of the T20 World Cup. And they'll be keen to get another shot at it this time next year when the finals will be played closer to home in Australia. But first, the PNG boys will have to come through qualifying in either February or May.
Richard Ewart there reporting on the Barramundi's debut appearance at the T20 World Cup. And finally, we're ending today's program with a love story. When Australian Stephanie Wheeler arrived in Solomon Islands back in 2019, she never thought she'd end up meeting the love of her life. But then Tommy Asau came along. They only had a few short months together before the coronavirus pandemic shut down international borders and the couple were torn apart. But now, after 551 days of separation, they've been reunited.
We've just had our 2-year anniversary, so we met in September 2019 over here in Solomon Islands. So I was here for work, doing some malaria research work in quite a remote part of Solomon Islands. That's where he happens to be from. And he was actually the first person that I ever met in Solomon's right at the airport, which was really cool. So I was coming over with friends who've known him for about 10 years. He just has the most incredible smile and yeah, we just really connected. And so I was there for a couple of weeks doing this malaria work and we just got to know each other then. I think we just connected, I don't know, when you know, you know. I know that's so corny and I never used to really believe people that said that, but we just clicked instantly and it was just really easy and fun. And I don't think we ever would have imagined at the time that it would end up this, but we decided to give it a crack anyway.
Amongst the lush green palm trees shading white sandy beaches, Tommy and Stephanie fell in love. When Stephanie had to return home to Newcastle in Australia, they committed to a long distance relationship where they talked to each other every day.
So we were like messaging and video chatting on Messenger and stuff. Yeah, I think it was just that feeling of when something happens, just wanting to talk to him about it and vice versa, and just enjoying getting to know someone in that way.
At Christmas time, Tommy flew to Australia and spent the holidays with her family, and then she went back to Solomon Islands with him. But in March 2020, the coronavirus pandemic hit. Australia shut down its borders, and Stephanie got on the last plane out of the Sols.
So like early January, my colleagues and I were saying, is this the big one? So my particular area is working in pandemic preparedness work. So I wasn't shocked that this was so big and protracted as a public health event. But in terms of the response and restrictions level, I never could have foreseen that it would be like this.
Midway through 2020, Stephanie and Tommy realized that the pandemic wouldn't be ending anytime soon. So started to apply for exemptions so that Tommy could enter Australia on the grounds of immediate family member and compassionate and compelling reasons. Their application was denied. So they tried again and then denied. All up, Stephanie says they were rejected 16 times.
When the borders closed, of course, as an epidemiologist, I appreciate and understand the rationale. It literally saved people's lives, and I appreciate that. But the ongoing, it was just the endlessness of it that was really difficult. So we would apply, and applications for most people, I think ours went up to about 100 pages. They want to know that you have joint bank accounts, that you have a joint lease, that you have plans for the future. They want receipts of things that you've bought together. They want photo, like screenshots of messages that you've sent to each other. They want call logs to show that you talk to each other every day. And what the automated rejection email from ABF, from memory, it is something like, allowing this person entry does not outweigh the risk to the Australian community. And so this was something that I found very, very difficult, because in our situation, he is coming from a country that still to this day in October 2021 has never had COVID community transmission and was still never going to be allowed to come in. It was awful. It was really, really horrible. You feel like you're bearing your entire soul to a robot, or, you know, someone on the end of the ABF email who gets to look at all of the most intimate details of our relationship and then goes, nah.
The process took a toll on their mental health, so she turned to her local MP, Sharon Clayton, for support.
She took our case to Parliament and represented us there, which was just really wonderful, because it really feels like you're just nothing. You're just a pawn in the game. And for those of us who've been separated from family and loved ones, whoever that is, it feels like we've sacrificed a lot for the last year and a half to keep everybody safe. You know, having Sharon's support was really wonderful. When she gave her statement in Parliament, it was full of hears and all this and stuff across the room, but ABF, that doesn't mean anything.
After trying what seemed like every avenue to get Tommy into Australia so they could continue their lives, they decided instead for Stephanie to move to Solomon Islands.
We are so lucky. Like, we are, and I never would have thought that a year ago, but we really are lucky ones in that I have such a niche work role that I was able to actually get into the Solomons. I'm supporting the government here in implementing an epidemiology training program. It's a very, very lengthy, complex process to get in. Because of my role, I was able to. And so we decided that we would take a break from doing the exemptions into Australia because it was not going to work in our favor. So we started in January to just focus on getting me here. So that process started in March, and I arrived here at the beginning of September.
When Stephanie eventually arrived in the country, she had to do 3 weeks of quarantine. But she says it was all worth the wait.
Yeah, 21 days later, we finally got to see each other again. People kept asking, like, are we nervous? And I was like, no, I'm not nervous. I couldn't even imagine how it would feel. And people had kept trying to tell me along the way, oh, you should plan what you're going to do when you get together, and you should try to visualize this. And I just couldn't. It just felt just painful, I think, to try to hope and plan for things, and then it would just constantly get dashed. So I hadn't even really thought anything. And then we saw each other, and it was just like I could breathe. Like, it was just like a full body sigh, and we just stood there holding each other. And I think I still feel like that. Like, it still feels like my body is just coming down from this immense long adrenaline push. Then we moved into our home, and it's just been so easy and comfortable. And like, people kept saying to me, oh, it'll be like no time, like, you'll kind of forget about it. That will never happen. It's become such a core part of our story. And, you know, for us, I really don't want to become toxic positivity about this, because there's very little that's positive. I think he and I worked exceptionally hard to not just keep our relationship going, but to really strengthen our relationship and to make it really solid. So I'm glad that we made the choice to do that. But yeah, no, it's been just so lovely to be back together again, and just to do the normal stuff. Like, all we want to do is go to the market and have brunch on the weekend. And, you know, we come and sit out here in the morning and have our coffee looking at the view. And, you know, we go for a walk, went to the beach, just normal life stuff that just makes life enjoyable and lovely to share with someone. It's been so nice.
Australian epidemiologist Stephanie Wheeler, reunited now with her partner Tommy Asau in the Solomon Islands. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Talia Olatia. Fafatai le fa'alonglongu manawia le aso.